Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
First of all, I want to say that even though I might be at variance with the way Natasha Akpoti has conducted herself and her whole drama in the Senate in the past 1 week, I am ever not in tune with the way and manner that the Senate has suspended her.
The Nigerian Senate suspends a lawmaker over sexual harassment allegation.
What we are saying, and I'm holding up, is that we have the capacity to bring back peace in the Northwest and the Southwest, to stop the violence. The problem is political.
Cameroon opposition leader promises to quickly resolve the country's security crisis after the coming presidential contest.
First of all, the Inspectorate of Government, legally on paper, is well empowered to act within their power to ensure that public officers are transparent in the declaration of their assets.
And a Ugandan parliamentarian plans to encourage fellow lawmakers to make their assets declaration public to ensure transparency and accountability. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, a prominent human rights defender says the suspension of Senator Natasha Akpoti is illegal and an affront to the rule of law. Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa also says the Senate should not have acted until a court case is settled before taking action against Akpoti. His remarks come after the Nigerian Senate announced the suspension of Akpoti for 6 months for violating the Senate's rules. This after accusing Senate President Godswill Akpabio of sexual harassment, an accusation Akpabio firmly denies. For the latest development, I reach Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa.
First of all, I want to say that even though I might be at variance with the way Natasha Akpoti has conducted herself and her whole drama in the Senate in the past 1 week, I am ever not in tune with the way and manner that the Senate has suspended her. The law really is that you really cannot even suspend a member of a legislative house because he's not an employee of the legislative house. That is to say, a legislative house being a senator, house of representative, or any name so called, is one that their members were elected by the people. So only the people can recall a member of the legislative house. So if you suspend Senator Natasha Akpoti Uduaghan for 6 months, it means that his people will not be represented for 6 months in the House of Senate.
As a lawyer, do you think Senator Akpoti can seek legal redress based on this action taken against her by the Senate?
Yes, she has a very good case. In the case of Dino Melaye and Federal House of Representatives, it was stated that you cannot even suspend a member of the House for more than one legislative day. That is to say, you can only suspend him for the next day you are sitting, after that will come back to the House. So it does appear that the Senate is using a sledgehammer to kill a fly. And their action is totally at variance with the law on the matter.
Sure. When Senator Natasha came up with the allegation, some people were suggesting that perhaps there should be an impartial investigation into this because this was serious enough and that the way the Senate handled it was not due process, they argue. As a lawyer, what is your take on that?
Well, the Senate has its rules, and by the rules of the Senate, you as a member, you cannot write a petition to the Senate. So I think they use technicality to knock her petition out, and I want to tell you, very sad, but rightly so. And the Senate also have a rule that when a case is in court, that you do not, they don't entertain matters that are in court. Senator Natasha Akpoti filed a suit in court. The Senate President's wife filed a suit in court. Mrs. Akpabio filed a suit in court. So there are two suits in court, and that also handles that part of that particular matters. But I am also of the opinion that since the matters are in court, the Senate should have waited for the court Because the Senate President says that he will not entertain a petition because the matter is in court, I feel it's unjust and unfair to suspend that when the same matter is in court. And that is the law.
Douglas, some people are suggesting that this allegation and counter-allegation from the Senate President and Senator Natasha basically undermines the trust Nigerians have on the Senate. What is your take on that?
As far as I'm concerned, it's a private issue between two persons. Nigerians have a way of elevating private morality into the public space. I feel that for the last 2 weeks, Nigerian Senate has stood still for Senator Natasha Akpoti. And I feel like whatever our issues are, both parties know what they are fighting over. And I feel that for it to dominate the public space for that long of a time, particularly because, though I do not support her suspension, I feel she does not have evidence. If you were to look at Monica Lewinsky's allegations against then-President Bill Clinton, you would see a lot of evidence to show that that sexual harassment actually took place. But the Senator Natasha Akpoti's case, she can't just come and say that this man sexually harassed me. And there is no evidence. She even said that she didn't tell her husband. So the whole thing, as far as I'm concerned, her allegations are clogged with a lot of inconsistencies. It leaves a lot to be desired. That's why, because I've analyzed her allegations vis-a-vis the position of the Senate President, she does not have any iota of evidence. And I want to tell you something. I want the world to listen, to hear me now. That Senator Natasha Akpoti had any evidence, the whole world would have been let loose.
Attorney Douglas Ogbankwa is a prominent human rights defender. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. In Cameroon, the newly elected presidential candidate of the Opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF, says he plans to quickly resolve the ongoing crisis in Anglophone regions of the country if elected president. Joshua Osi, who is also the chairman of the party, was unanimously elected by delegates during the party's extraordinary convention held in the capital, Yaounde. He also says the SDF is open to forming an alliance to win the coming presidential contest. But critics say it will be difficult to defeat incumbent President Paul Biya and his governing Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM. It has dominated the country's political landscape for nearly four decades. For more about his plans and his electoral prospect, I reached Joshua Osi.
I must say that we worked hard towards it, so it's rewarding, and I feel humbled because it wasn't easy, and right now the real task is ahead of us. So we're looking for much more work and many more challenges.
One of the major campaigns you made is that if elected as the next president of Cameroon, you will solve the ongoing violence in some Anglophone areas of the country. How do you plan on doing this?
What we are saying, and I'm holding up, is that we have the capacity to bring back peace in the Northwest and the Southwest, to stop the violence. The problem is political. In bringing about this peace, in bringing about this end to violence, we will start the political process. We hope to end up in a major consultation, in a constitutional referendum within 3 years. But no other political party knows the Northwest and Southwest better than the Social Democratic Front. And so we have looked at it. We have talked to nearly all the stakeholders, and we know that within 3 months or a bit more, we have the capacity to make sure that the armed conflict ceases and that the violence ends.
What makes Joshua Nabangi Osi uniquely qualified to become the next president of the Republic of Cameroon?
Well, it's probably a long catalog, but one of the points that I can mention here is that I think, first of all, that today where Cameroon stands, we need somebody who can talk to all the parties, who can talk to all the political ends, and who can be a bridge, a unifying bridge, to make sure that we do not escalate into more violence in our country. Right now, what is going on is that the cleavages are really very deep, and that there is only the SDF out there, and the candidate of the SDF that I am, that clearly holds out to make sure that, or reaches out to make sure that we do not go further into these cycles of violence. Right now, there is a lot of it going on, which is mostly verbal, but we understand that if Mr. Biya gets one more mandate, we may no longer be able to control this country. And we want to avoid that, and that's why we think that we need someone who understands the diversity of this country, who has a political program that addresses the issue of this diversity, notably with the proposal for a federal form of the state, and who can talk to all the parties, who can talk just to those in power and those who are adamantly against the powers that be in Yaoundé. And so we believe that it is a chance for peace in our country. It is a chance to build a new social contract. And this proposal is coming from Joshua Osi. This proposal is coming from the Social Democratic Front. And so it is a real opportunity for the Cameroonian people.
What makes you confident that you'll be able to defeat the CPDM, the ruling party, which has dominated the political landscape in Cameroon since the early 1980s?
Well, the first point is that I am probably the first or the only one who is insisting on the fact that if you want to win against your opponent, you need to know who your opponent is. And for a very long time, Cameroonians, especially in the opposition, have been making the mistake to go into an election against the CPDM party. The CPDM party is not in power. There is a group of civil servants who have actually seized the powers in Yaoundé. And this state capture is what is dragging Cameroon down. And that is because of this state capture and because they want to maintain this state capture that they're trying to keep the aging president in place because they know they can better control him. So we understand that. So we're addressing the right issue because we're not in a fight against a party that is not in power. They are as much out of power as we. So we are fighting against a group of civil servants who have captured the state and who are using the CPDM as a tool to remain politically relevant, but we know that we need to fight them and we don't need to fight the party. We've been fighting the party too long, and we understood that those in command are those sitting around Mr. B, and those are the people we need to defeat. So that's why we're fighting against the system and not against Mr. B, because obviously we are aware that if Mr. B goes and the system remains in place, we'll have the same problems tomorrow that we have today.
Joshua Osi is the newly elected presidential candidate of the opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF. He spoke with me from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé. In The Gambia, a survey conducted by Afrobarometer showed a majority of citizens want the death penalty for serious crimes in the West African country. This despite the government moratorium on executions in 2018. The findings show that 80% of the survey believes that the death penalty is a fair punishment for some crimes, including murder. It also shows a decline in the trust in the judiciary, with 43% saying judges and magistrates are corrupt. Madi Jobate is a prominent human rights defender and the head of the Edward Francis Small Center for Right and Justice. He tells me that popular support for the death penalty for serious crimes will undermine the fight for human rights in The Gambia.
I am concerned, whereas I understand the background, I mean, why people would want the death penalty, it's still concerning because it would be a major retrogression, and it could be something that could translate or move into other things that would go to affect the wider human rights spectrum. Normally, culturally, religiously, particularly, you know, Islam, which most Gambians belong to, killing would be considered that if one kills one, you should be killed. And secondly, I think poor law enforcement in the country has not augured well to curb crime, particularly murder, And so people's frustration of all of that creates a situation where people wish to have the death penalty instituted. Actually, one would say, in fact, it's in our constitution. In 1997, when the constitution was promulgated, it was said that within 10 years, the parliament will review the desirability of the death penalty or not. That has never been done.
Talking about the moratorium, in February 2018, President Adama Barrow announced a moratorium on executions, and by September of the same year, the Gambia ratified the protocol. But why isn't this tamping down the popularity of people wanting the death penalty to be used for serious crimes?
Yeah, that is simply because the prevalence of murders in the country. So we've had instances of armed robberies with sexual violence and indeed murder itself. And a lot of the cases, either the culprits are not apprehended or court processes take so long. And so all of this create a frustration in the people so that, you know, people look at it as if law enforcement is not effective. And so even if you still call for a death penalty, it has to go through a due process. So it wouldn't necessarily make any difference. But the fact that, you know, it has not been effective creates that frustration. And so whilst at the policy legal level, one may say there has been progress given the moratorium, and given that I think in we've had at least one case where death penalty has been imposed but not executed, it still has not helped, simply because the population feels frustrated that crime, particularly murder, continues to take place, and there seems to be no effective tackling of it.
The survey also shows that the respect or trust Gambians have in institutions, including the judiciary, is declining. Can this be an indicator of the reason why the death penalty is popular?
I'm not quite sure, but, certainly, the decisions would, do take place at the court, so that even if there's a case of murder and a prosecution takes place, it's the courts that would decide. The court, as I said, there has been one case of death penalty which has not been, implemented. But in any case, the courts generally would impose custodial sentences which take a long time, quite a considerable period. So I saw that survey, and it's a survey, and so people have their perceptions, and I personally have trust and confidence in the judiciary.
What do you think can be done to reverse this trend, especially as a human rights activist?
So the way to deal with this, because crime doesn't happen in a vacuum, and what we are seeing is in the Gambia is the dire socioeconomic conditions, which is translating into crime, drugs abuse, but also irregular migration and so on. And so to curb crime so that the instances of murder is reduced, it is important that the government focus on fulfillment of social and economic rights, creating opportunities, so that people would have the means to be able to earn a decent living, but at the same time also ensuring that basic social services are available, whether it's electricity or water supply, healthcare, education, and so on. Because all of those help to reduce frustration and anger in the people, and so on. But, above all, also to improve the overall governance.
Madi Jobate is an academic in the Democratic Republic of Congo, is hailing public support for sanctions imposed on Rwanda over its alleged role in the ongoing conflict in the eastern part of the country. Professor Antoine Lukongo, a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa, says the international community must also encourage an inter-Rwandan dialogue as part of the effort to resolve the conflict. His remarks come after Germany became the latest Western development partner to announce it was halting new development aid to Rwanda. Kigali is accused of supporting the M23 rebels who have seized territory in the eastern DRC with little resistance from the National Army. Rwanda denies supporting the M23 and says that Germany's action is, quote, wrong and counterproductive. Professor Antoine Lukungu tells me that the administration in Kinshasa must also reorganize the army to bolster security, enable its ability to protect the country's territorial integrity.
Congolese in the diaspora are doing a great job. They are now campaigning in the German parliament, also in the European Union, in Belgium, everywhere. So we can see that things are moving. At least now, the international public opinion is very well informed about Rwanda's intention in Congo. That's very positive. But I doubt that those sanctions are going to be binding or compelling.
Why do you think the sanctions now being imposed will have any impact on the conflict in the Congo?
Yes, are not going to be compelling because, first of all, the same European countries are still supporting Rwanda's operation in Mozambique against terror there, they say. While at the same time, Kagame is accused in eastern Congo. Secondly, we saw even during Kabila's time that the European asked M23 to withdraw from Goma in 48 hours, and they did so. But now, with this sanction, they are not asking the M23 to withdraw either from Bukavu or from Goma, but they are asking Felix Tshisekedi to talk to them. And they are not asking the M23 to lay down their arms, contrary to what happened last time when Kabila was in power.
Do you think if the European countries or development partners demand that the M23 retreat from this territory that they have seized, it will help bring peace in eastern Congo?
Yes, because that is in accordance with the Luanda Peace Accord and even the East African Community Peace Accord. And I've just guessed that President Obasanjo and the former Prime Minister of Ethiopia and President Uhuru Kenyatta are just coming to revive this peace accord. That is for M23 to withdraw, to pull back and regroup somewhere and begin talks with the government in Kinshasa. That was the roadmap, the Rwanda roadmap, even the Nairobi roadmap. But like I said to you, these sanctions are not going to be very binding because the rebels are still advancing. Now, if they take Uvira, very soon they will be in Katanga. And if they take Katanga, it will be catastrophic for the government because Katanga is the what you call here the lungs of the Congolese economy because the mining sector is concentrated in Katanga. And I would say that these sanctions, if Western countries, Western power are serious, they should go, like I said to you last time, they should go further and calling on Rwanda to organize an inter-Rwandan dialogue.
Do you think that's the inter-Rwandan dialogue would have an impact on resolving the conflict in the Congo?
Of course, because the many pretexts of Kagame and even of Museveni is that Rwanda and Uganda still face threats from Congo, from FDLR, suspected of having committed the genocide in 1994 in Rwanda. Now, for 30 years now, Uganda, Rwanda have been intervening in Congo. How can they tell the whole world that they could not neutralize these people after over 30 years. No. No serious people would believe that. So I think that if the Hutu and the Tutsi dialogue in Rwanda organize a dialogue, and the Hutu are not just in Congo, they are also in Kenya, they are also in Tanzania, they are in every country in the region. So why just target Congo? Because there are other hidden agenda.
Professor Antoine Lokongo is a lecturer at the University of Kinshasa. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. A Ugandan parliamentarian plans to encourage fellow lawmakers to make their declaration of assets public to ensure transparency and accountability in the fight against graft. Attorney Mathias Mpuuga, who is also the leader of the political coalition, the Democratic Alliance, or DA, is calling for constitutional reforms. He says the Anti-Graft Inspectorate of Government, or IGG, should step up its fight to root out corruption in the East African country. His comments come as the IGG calls for a constitutional amendment that will enable the institution to publicly publish the assets of top government officials. Betty Kamya also says the new measure will give Ugandans clear oversight and information needed to fight against corruption. Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga tells me that the IGG must do more against the problem.
First of all, the Inspectorate of Government, legally on paper, is well empowered to act within their power to ensure that public officers are transparent in the declaration of their assets. And apart from the lack of the word publication on paper, I am not aware of any legal bar that stops the IGG, even without an amendment to the law, even without a particular law, because the Access to Information Act, as well as the Inspectorate Act, is such that a member of the public, on request, can actually access the nature and manner of declaration of the assets of any public officer. But if the Inspectorate of Government thinks that special legislation would make matters more transparent, then so be it. But my only concern is that the inspectorate, at one time, dared public officers by saying that it's going to ask them to account for their lifestyle, to do a lifestyle audit. That was merely a threat. She never acted on it. I hope this time around she's serious about doing that. But like I said, even within the existing law, she's able to publish it. There's no legal bar.
According to some civil society activists and anti-corruption activists, they believe that, you know, publicly publishing this asset declaration or earnings of public officials will add more oversight, accountability, and transparency. So, in their view, the law has to be strengthened to add more visibility to the fight against corruption by having this transparency clause included in the measure. Where do you stand on that?
Like I observed, I do not have any problem with a demand of any public officer being open about what they own and how they acquired it. It's one way we can strengthen our transparency legislation and framework. But my only problem with whatever we have is not just about the law, it's about the will. Because the biggest form of corruption that has existed in Uganda is open political corruption. And it's been over time being incubated and supported in a way, indirectly, by political patronage. As long as you've not overcome political patronage, there's no nature, there's no amount of legislation, there's no volume of legislation that will help in corruption. Corruption here is a way of life because politics has allowed it to be as such. And therefore, the first thing to act on is political will. And as long as you have a political framework, a regime that hangs on allowing corruption prevail as part of its mainstay, so legislation can only be on paper and in action to be improbable, that it will change the way corruption is viewed and is prosecuted in this country.
As a member of parliament and a prominent opposition figure in Uganda, Would you approach some of your colleague members of parliament to come up with some form of transparency and accountability measure in the fight against corruption? Because you have been a proponent of fighting corruption and rooting out corruption in Uganda.
Probably now that that has come up, maybe we would, I would encourage myself and colleagues to move fast and make our assets publicly known. I have no problem. Probably it will be a very good challenge on our part to move fast and make whatever we own. I am aware of some particular opposition leaders that have assets abroad, and then they pretend they have nothing. But of course, we want to know what they have as part of engendering utmost transparency. The opposition has a duty, and I agree. We probably have a bigger duty to the population to even challenge regime supporters about transparency. So I concur with the opposition should be moved and we should move fast. I'll be part of the group that will move to make whatever I own publicly seen and known.
Attorney Mathias Mpuuga is a Ugandan parliamentarian and the leader of the political coalition, the Democratic Alliance, or DA. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In Mozambique, a lawyer and a political commentator is expressing doubt about claims that main opposition figure Venancio Mondlane was targeted for assassination. Rodrigo Rocha also expressed concern about gunshots fired by the Rapid Intervention Unit during a protest by supporters of the opposition leader in the capital, Maputo. This, as Mondlane is expected to report to the police next week. It comes as newly elected President Daniel Chapo signed an agreement with opposition political parties on Wednesday. For more insight into the latest political development, I reached attorney Rodrigo Rocha.
Well, first of all, I have certain doubts that there was an attempt of assassination of Michel Mondlane. And the reason for that is, from what we've seen, he's been able to circulate freely all around the country. He's doing mass gathering in everywhere he wants. And there's never been any sort of attempt to anyone, including himself. What happened yesterday is that there was the signature of an agreement and a memorandum of understanding between the president and all the political parties with the relevance to the current elected bodies in Mozambique. I'm talking about the national parliament. I'm talking about the provincial parliament and every party that has somehow been able to elect any sort of official, including now the president, made an agreement with a roadshow to what they keep saying that it's going to be the peace structure, legal structure for the next steps to be even. So there was a very big ceremony in one of the prime spots here in Maputo. And Mr. Venancio Mondlane, who is not part on these discussions, was trying to force himself to go closer to that location with a lot of number of supporters. Because of the security matters, those areas were logically with some constraints of movement.
Rodrigo, some people are suggesting that there has to be an investigation to find out what really happened before the gunshots because of the assassination attempt, because they argue that if this is not done, the tension could increase. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that there is, first of all, there is no attempt of assassination. As I mentioned to you, Mr. Mondlane has been doing these rallies all around the country and putting himself on the roof of a car with no sort of protection. If there was an attempt of assassination, they would not be waiting for a day in which there was a lot of talks about peace to do that. No one would be doing that. So this is a false allegation in which the facts are clearly demonstrating the opposite. But above all, Mr. Mondlane has been summoned to appear at the public prosecutor's early next week. I think it's on Monday. And this is very strange that he's now coming up with this new wording about the fact that he's not in in any sort of a known location. This is very strange. And it can lead to the conclusion.
You think this is a diversionary tactic?
That's what I was about to say. This leads us to the conclusion that this is a tactic to divert the attention from the fact that he has been summoned to appear at the public prosecutors and trying to create more drama all around this issue.
Following the agreement between the president and other opposition leaders, how will this help in bringing tensions down?
Well, there's a very good answer for that. And let me explain you that from the moment that the election chapter has been closed, Mr. Valencia Mondlane is not linked to any sort of a party where he can be part of any sort of opposition. The opposition is not made by individuals that lost elections, but rather by the parties that have the second most voted seat on the national parliament. So the opposition leader, which is currently Mr. Forquilha, he was part of that signature event that took place yesterday. So the opposition party was there. The opposition leader, the leader of that party, was there. Mr. Valencia Mondlane is just trying to keep an agenda of his own within the society in Mozambique. I don't feel and I don't see how he can still claim to be part of the opposition where he cuts the ties with the political party that he was representing and that was assisting him during the last elections.
Rodrigo Rocha is a lawyer and a political commentator. He spoke with me from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. In Zambia, the opposition coalition called Tonse Alliance says it will not accept any constitutional amendment ahead of next year's general election. Sean Tembo, the spokesperson for the coalition, says the group will use all legal means to stop any plans by the ruling United Party for National Development, or UPND, to amend the constitution before the 2026 polls. But the information minister and chief government spokesperson, Cornelius Mutua, has dismissed the opposition allegation that he plans to amend the constitution. It comes after supporters of the UPND say the charge is yet another attempt by the Tonse Alliance to stay relevant and make the government unpopular. For more insight and the latest developments, I reach Sean Temple.
So for us as Tonse Alliance, we have made a resolution that we are not going to entertain any form of constitutional amendment proposed by the ruling UPND party that they intend to do prior to the 2026 general elections, for the simple reason that we do not trust the intentions of the ruling party. The ruling party has been for a while now peddling a narrative that there are certain clauses in the constitution which are non-contentious and that need to be incorporated in the form of an amendment prior to 2026.
Cornelius Mutua, the chief government spokesperson and also the information minister, has rejected or dismissed your concerns as a non-issue, and that the ruling party has not in any way made any plans to have the constitution amended before the 2026 general election.
Well, if that was the statement by Honorable Cornelius Mutua, then it appears that he does not monitor what his boss, the Republican president, says. Because just about 3 days ago, President Hakainde Hichilema is on record stating very clearly that he intends to undertake a process of delimitation of certain constituencies in the country because they are very big based on geographical size. And President Hichilema made those sentiments during his address to the National Assembly on national values and principles. There is no way of undertaking delimitation of constituencies without a constitutional amendment.
What are the pathways to stop this if indeed the ruling party will take such a path, although it has denied that such plans are even invoked at all?
Well, we are going to use any and all means at our disposal. So we are going to fight any constitutional amendments prior to 2026 through Parliament, through our members of Parliament, as well as through civil society protests, which we intend to coordinate, as well as through any other means available at our disposal, because we do not want to allow the UPND party to find a back route of being re-elected into office next year. They want to amend the constitution in order for them to remove the 50% plus one clause. They want to remove various other progressive clauses in the constitution, clauses which hold them accountable, clauses which require the Electoral Commission of Zambia to be made up of commissioners that are independent of any political affiliation, because they are afraid that we might use those clauses of the constitution to challenge the Electoral Commission of Zambia.
Sean Tembo is the spokesperson for the opposition coalition Tonse Alliance. He spoke with me from the Zambian capital, Lusaka. In Malawi, the chairperson of the non-governmental organization's Gender Coordination Network is calling on the police and political groups to take action to stop the violence targeting women during elections. Maggie Katherewa Banda also says both the police and political parties have not taken serious steps to stop ongoing violence, despite repeated promises to do so. This after citing attacks against a female parliamentarian, the publicity secretary of the governing Malawi Congress Party, and the harassment of former President Joyce Banda on social media platforms, as well as the recent stripping of MCP women supporters in the commercial capital, Blantyre. For more insight into the call for urgent action to stop politically related violence in the coming elections, I reach Maggie Katherewa Banda.
So what has been happening of late is that we have experienced cases of violence against women in elections. We have seen women from different political parties actually being targeted. So we have seen women being undressed because they are wearing party colors. We have seen even female MPs being attacked right within parliament premises. The former president of Malawi, Joyce Banda, has been attacked several times in the media, on social media. So this is almost like a trend that is happening to women. So that's why this time around we're saying that there has to be a sense of responsibility and agency from the police and political parties to do something about violence. So what we're expecting is that, for example, the police, where a crime has been committed, they need to apprehend the culprits and also bring them to book. In terms of the political parties, we're calling upon them to work with their supporters so that they don't commit violence against women.
Why do you think cases of violence targeting women, particularly in Malawi, are rising?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. For me, I think it's that societal attitude where they don't expect women to be leaders. So as soon as women leave their private space and go into the public space, then it becomes a problem. So it's a way of demotivating women, it's a way of discouraging women from taking up positions in the public spaces. So this is what we have seen. But also the impunity that goes along with it, because most of the cases, they don't go to conclusion. So because people don't see the conclusion of it, so there's no deterrent factor for them not to commit violence anymore. So we really think that more has to be done for violence to be curbed.
Talking about political parties, you don't think political parties are doing enough to stop their supporters from engaging in these kinds of politically related violence against women?
Exactly. Yes, that's what we feel, because it's in rare cases where we have seen political parties condemning violence, especially when it has happened to members of other political parties which are not their own. So we really feel that political parties are not doing a lot. They're not doing much in terms of addressing this issue. So for us, what we are saying is that political parties need to be accountable for their actions. They need to work with their supporters. They need to come out very clearly and condemn any type of violence that happens, regardless of which political party you're talking about.
Talking about the police, is your organization engaging the police and other security agencies and other stakeholders?
Exactly. Actually, we had a proper breakfast meeting with the police, where actually before that, we had a press briefing, which involved directors of women from all the major political parties, because at that time we felt that apart from us talking about it, we need to have the women politicians themselves condemning violence and also standing up for their rights. So we convened a press briefing, Warwick together to Oxfam, where women made demands, and therefore, as a follow-up to the demands which they made, then we had a breakfast meeting with the Inspector General of Police and other people in the police, where women were able to present their grievances and also called upon the police to act on cases of violence. So that's why we're saying to the police to say, remember the commitment that you made to the women and then rise up to the occasion and protect them and also make sure that those that are committing violence are brought to book so that justice is meted out.
Secretary Generals, our women organizations and political parties in Malawi came together to kick against violence against women. Will this help?
Yeah, we felt it's going to help, because sometimes it's just NGOs talking about it. People take it lightly. But when it is the people that are actually feeling the pinch, then people are going to maybe take stock and see what is happening, and then they're going to act upon it. And then for us, we are also saying that the strength to it is that it was women from all political parties, all major political parties. So meaning to say that it's not even a political issue at the end of the day. It's something that we should all be looking at and say, we are not going to accept this in Malawi. So this is what we are calling for. We are looking forward to a nation that will be able to say we cannot accept violence, regardless of which member of a political party has been affected, whether it's in government, whether it's in the opposition, but the fact that it's violence against women, we are not going to tolerate that.
Maggie Katharewa Banda is the chairperson of the non-governmental organization Gender Coordination Network. She spoke with me from the Malawian capital, Lilongwe. This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, music from our African collection, but first. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
But in this thing, what you do, don't want yummy height. Give up or don't talk. You make me head big, now the boy draw the fly like kite. You look me the go. Now air at your weed, then they call me the dynamite. Opa, ten ten. Cause anytime I come, I snap bang, I the odds the lights. There we go. Give a light, I don't go. I can't act like me in a bolo. Me arms white, I cover. And now it's time to count the dollar.
Game change.
No more knocking for the rest, and I log with the upgrade. Lamborghini swagger, me and cack for the holiday. Baby, let me jam,
let me jam. Fine breeze.
Now in the blow, now me lotty, cause the pockets are the loose.
Never.
BSK say menace, less feast. Now the level down, all the cool like ice freeze. Done for this thing, me na dada. Papa na the game, me na fada. You know when the bitch, you a killer, let me give him a dope track, and something to remember. Why you let know the lap, now we gonna see a cancer, the VIP with my nigga Rara. Them on say make we enjoy one life, 2024 and stress the boy, but I survive.
But in this thing, what you do, don't bong yam me height. Give up or don't talk. Boy, do they fly like kite? You look me the go. Now air at your weed, then they call me the dynamite.
Opa, ten ten.
Cause anytime I come, I snap bang, I the odds the lights.
Odds the lights.
There we go. Never like it. I don't go. I can't act like me in a bolo. Me arms white, I cover. And now it's time to counsel the
dollar. We got fuel the plane, and make it take off.
Make it take off.
First class to me, why name it your love?
Name it your love.
Some a pinch find the weight, get a pinch in the drip. Put my valley up, this guy, man, it's a bad off.
Yeah, bad off.
The tip of me cigar, it's lighter than 10. Shady smoke, we are puffed by me Cuba.
Me Cuba.
Sand up guy in face, shiver like a biba. One come behind safe to this fine boy, Cuba.
Sick
is all where I pass, now we junction. Me boys, then they shine me glass for clear vision. Sick is all when I enter the booth. Some a bits, the beats again. 12 with extension.
Accent.
If it tastes, yeah, fresh, but the other brand swaggy accent.
Now
I sent to. Some a colon smell dope. If I pass you, yeah, left, you make sense.
But in this thing, what you do, don't bong yummy height.
Give up or don't talk. You make me head
boy just they fly like kite. Look me they go. Now air to me, then they call me the dynamite. Opa, ten ten. Cause any time I come, once I bang I the hot the lights. Hot the lights. There we go. Never like it. I don't go. I can't act like me na bolo. Me arms white, I cover. And now it's time to count the dollar. Never like it. I don't go. I can't act like me na bolo. Me arms white, I cover. And now it's time to count the dollar. There we go.
Knows wherever she goes, she just kill him with the pose. Catwalk dips and her time is unbrisked. And good God Almighty, this Titiana Rose. Brady boy, Johnny Cole. Monster on water. One tap on the tomba, like could the beat butter. No other chick better. Her top paragon when at the bottom, you the city. Damn, you not look to you a big fashionista. You're an illista. You're setting the record like you work for a rister. Come a little closer. I can be your customer. Guarding your body, girl, your fragrance is monster. Dior. Tonka, you ahead of the race, now you carry baton. Gucci, Prada, then I'm going to get you, you balance them with you, I got.
She rocking Gucci and Dior, she looking better than before.
Amenitoa majangani. Sio kama mimi mwema sana, ama nina mengi ya kumridhisha. Ana mipango mingi na mimi.
That was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer David Vandy, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the liar's house will be destroyed by his own tongue. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.